Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing real good. Get a little Christmas shopping done a little early this year. Early, I guess, is not all that early, is it, to be shopping now?
For a guy?
Yeah, it's pretty early for
anytime
pretty early
before
for a
about
at this
the
point.
This time December is early, yeah, for sure. You're doing great.
Yeah. Anything better than Christmas Eve is doing pretty good for a guy, isn't it? So
yeah, no, nothing so. Like stopping by the old 7-Eleven on Christmas Eve and seeing if they got any toys, right? So what have you been shopping? Tell me about this. Have you found anything speculist friendly in your Christmas shopping endeavors?
There is a website I've got to point you to, Phil. ThinkGeek. Now, I mean, we're doing free advertising for these people because they haven't paid us a thing, but it's hilarious. I believe these are the same people that did Tauntaun sleeping bags last year. It just cracked me up, you know. I mean,
the Tauntaun sleeping bag. We all need one of those.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
I believe the tagline is, "And you think they smell bad on the outside, right?"
Exactly. Your kids can unzip this Tauntaun, and it looks like guts on the inside and everything. He crawls in. He's nice and cozy, you know. So, pretty hilarious. I thought that was great. But new thing that got this year is disease plush toys. So, you know, you can be the outstanding parent that gave your kid anthrax, you know, a little plush toy, you know, version of these different germs. I mean, they got Ebola, you know. I mean,
a plush toy anthrax.
Exactly.
Plush virus. Oh, that's
exactly.
Awesome.
Yeah, you got a little E. coli. I think the E. coli is the cutest one. You know, it's got little legs on it and everything. So, you know, you're the. I told my kids, this is what you get if you're naughty. You know, and we. Get anthrax.
There you go. Yeah, anthrax. Don't make me get out the anthrax. No, you're gonna have Child Protective Services looking you up, Stephen, if you keep talking
yeah,
that way.
You know, any moment now. Yeah, they're gonna be banging down the door, and so the. The radio show gets interrupted tonight. That's all it is. Don't worry too much about it. So,
okay, fair enough. Well, I'll just keep talking. I'll play both parts, as I so often do. So, you know, in my head, right? Stephen should say this, and then I can.
Oh gosh. Well, you got any gift ideas? What's going on with you?
Yeah, I've got a terrific gift suggestion for anyone who is interested in getting an e-reader. An ebook reader and stepping lightly into the world of the tablet computer. I got my Kindle Fire today.
Oh, and, yeah, man. Awesome.
Yeah. So let me recommend it. I mean, based on a few hours use, I haven't been able to fully exploit it, but so cool. I mean, you know, I opened it up and I actually pulled it out of the box and accidentally turned the power on in the process of pulling it out of the box, and it comes up as soon as I'm on Wi-Fi, it finds all my books. It's like Amazon has already like preset it for my account, right? And it's like, you know, here's your library. Enjoy reading it on your new device. It's just so totally cool. And if you're an Amazon Prime member, you do the Amazon Prime thing. Do you have a?
Absolutely.
I'm sure. You watch the free videos on the unlimited streaming, right?
Absolutely, and I got Amazon Prime originally about 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's been longer than that. I think the year my youngest was born, basically, my wife was busy with him, and so for Christmas that year, I said, okay, we're going to do all the shopping. I'm going to do it by Amazon. Became an Amazon Prime member. I figured I'd just be a member just for that year, and just for that holiday season, and then would drop it after that. But then,
right.
I became addicted to that. How simple that was. If there's something that I feel like I want to get for this family, myself, or whatever, as long as I don't have to have it this second, in 2 days it's fast enough. Click, 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 and it's on the way. And
I'm a huge Amazon Prime fan, and one of the things that that it makes possible is you spend there was this article going around on Yahoo actually today about this woman talking about how Amazon Prime turned her into a shopping machine, right? She's just like buying stuff all the time now because it's like so easy to just throw stuff in your cart. And there really is this phenomenon of, I might need one of those, while I happen to be logged on to Amazon, I might as well pick up a couple of those too. But I imagine that people who suffer from that in Amazon probably suffer from that in real life too, because I know I do. If I'm out,
I've picked up a few things,
I'll think of something else too, right? And next thing you know, you've spent $80 at Walgreens when you went to get razor blades or something like that, right?
Well, here's the difference though, Phil. If you're like a someone who has a problem with impulse buying, at least you can leave the store. When you're at home, you would have been safe, right?
Yeah.
But not anymore. I mean, if you've got a smartphone in your pocket,
that's right.
You never
it's
leave
It's there
the
all
store.
The time. It's open 24/7.
The store.
Exactly. It's open when there's nothing good on TV or there's no one to talk to. It's always sitting there. Yeah. It's true. But anyway, one of the things I love about Amazon is the digital streaming, which they were offering. They actually started offering that before Netflix did. And when I first got my Roku, I was using it just for Amazon sort of replaced Netflix replaced
They have almost the same exact stuff, I
do both now. I've got Netflix because it's a slightly broader library. But the thing is, on Amazon, you can get all the new stuff, right? You can rent something that's like brand new and you want to see it this week, and there it is. So I think they actually work pretty well together. But what's cool is, getting back to my new Kindle Fire that I just got today, pulling up the videos, and man, they play great. It's just like, wow, you got this little TV here watching your video. So anyway, I'm really pleased with it. I downloaded Flash Comics number 1, getting back to our discussion from a couple of weeks ago about the new 52, and I'm reading that online on your recommendation, and it's very cool. I don't have anything to compare it with other than my iPhone, right? I can't compare it to an iPad because I've not used an iPad. But compared to an iPhone, I have an immediate observation about the Kindle.
Okay.
It's bigger, much bigger. So there you go. That's mine.
Well, here's the thing about your new Kindle and the fact that you're an Amazon Prime member. You probably already know, but maybe some people in our audience don't know. You can borrow bestsellers if you're an Amazon Prime member and you have a Kindle, an actual Kindle. In other words, once a month, it's one book a month, you can borrow a book and read it, and then it's a little bit like being able to check something out of the library that way, and includes a lot of
free downloads of, and some of these are like bestsellers.
It's not like Huckleberry Finn or something. I mean, this is new stuff, and that's pretty cool. Now, it doesn't work, to my great chagrin, the lending like that doesn't work for somebody who just has like, I carry the iPhone around with me all the time, and it'd be great if I could use that feature on my Kindle app on my iPhone. No, you have to have
the device,
feature.
The actual Kindle device.
You actually have to have a Kindle, and so. Anyway, so you Amazon Prime plus an actual Kindle device means that you can do their Amazon lending thing, so which is pretty cool too.
Yeah, Sally notes that libraries are now arranging borrowing of ebooks, and I've seen that that trend following on MP3 books, which local public library here in Douglas County, where Colorado, where I live, started offering that. I guess, gosh, a couple years ago now, and they've moved on to ebooks. So, you know, there's this whole thing about, yeah, you can get one for free off Amazon, or you can get, you know, as many as you want to using your library card. There's just this awkward thing of once in a while you actually have to show up at the library and, like, get a card or, you know, replace it or something like that. So
yeah,
there's this whole, like, you know, human interaction thing that has to take place for that to work, right?
Right. Well, it's the software is called Overdrive. And mm-hmm. you can get the app for your iPhone or iPad or whatever, or your computer or whatever. Yeah, you do have to have a library card at your local library, and you can only borrow those ebooks that are available at your local library. It'd be nice if I could borrow an ebook from, you know, Library of Congress, but I can't do that. If you live in a place that has a great library system and they have a lot of ebooks, and that's just outstanding, and I understand. I read the review on the Kindle Fire, Phil, and it says that Overdrive is integrated better with the Kindle Fire than with any other device before. So
check out
Overdrive, and I imagine in the Denver area you've got some outstanding libraries that you can borrow from. So
I'm going to have to check.
And you may never have to buy a book.
I've put these three bookcases down in here in the basement. Tonight, after the show, I'm actually planning on loading up the last set of books. So this is really this interesting passing of the torch going on in my home as I'm, like, finally shelving all my books. Today I get my Kindle. So I don't know. There seems to be it's like, will I ever pull any of these down from the shelf again? I think I probably will, actually. But
yeah.
The worm has definitely turned. I'll be buying a lot more books electronically. I have been anyway. I mean, just reading them off my iPhone and reading them off my laptop. Sally mentioned above that she uses her laptop as a Kindle, and I had done that for quite a while. I had a Kindle reader on there. And I think probably out of the last dozen books I've purchased, not counting the Game of Thrones series, the George R. R. Martin Song of Fire and Ice, not counting those, which I had to buy because I had to have them on airplanes and they didn't have Kindle yet. I think every book I've bought, other than that, has been an electronic book. I've really made that transition that I said that people weren't going to make a few years ago. So I'm living proof that I'm living proof of how wrong I was, I guess, on that.
Phil, I just counted my ebook collection. You know, I think I've got well over 100 ebooks, and you know. It's just one of those things where you just I guess I got a little bit of an earlier start, Bill, it's another impulse thing. If for example somebody mentions a book on the show, there have been several shows where I had the book in my possession before the end of the show. You know, I already had downloaded it, and I love the feature of being able to do notes and highlights. And then I can, you know, if, for example, I'm going to talk about it on the show, I can pull up those notes and highlights and just and read from straight from the book the parts that I found interesting, or if I wanted to comment on something, I'd do a note, you know, and it'd be right there and on a single screen, and I could just read through what I found interesting about the book. So it's, there's a lot to be said for e-books and the regular books, good old fashioned books, they don't require power. You know, they last forever and ever and ever. You know, those are some great things. But e-books are now here with us, and they're the real deal now.
Absolutely, yeah. They are the way increasingly the way we read. They're the way we access what we think of as books, and regular books are going to go the way of, you know, scrolls or like handwritten books before type or something like, you know, I mean, they're going to become this interesting artifact that I think they'll be around for quite a while. Don't get me wrong. And, they've got a hold on our culture and on our imagination that won't let go easily. But ultimately, if you want the information, right, or if you just want access to the book, it's just so much easier to do this. I mean, it really is the same paradigm as moving from LPs to CDs and then from CDs to MP3s. You make that transition. Now, a lot of people are going back to vinyl. There's this kind of like retro vinyl movement, but everybody understands that's, you know, to be cool. It's just like a blip in the music industry.
It's a niche. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a niche. The real thrust of the music industry is elsewhere, and the real thrust of the publishing industry is going to move in that direction for good and for ill. But I think primarily for good. I'll tell you one thing. They've definitely captured from reading The Flash, number one. They've definitely captured the comic book experience, and as you pointed out last week or 2 weeks ago, enhanced it. You know, there's nothing missing from the joy of comics other than maybe the smell, I suppose. But it's like the artwork is there, and it you know, once you're immersed in it, once you're reading it, it's just exactly like reading a comic book always was. So I think from an experience standpoint, and just from a evolutionary standpoint, I agree with you. They're here to stay. Well, now speaking of the Flash and speaking of superheroes, we should move on to our topic of this evening, which is this is the age of superheroes. We're living in the age of superheroes. We've been saying for some time that human evolution is leading us into a distinct profile for humanity, and I have formulated that, Stephen. As you know, you want to go ahead and tell the world what they're going to evolve into for those who haven't heard.
We're all going to be billionaires. I don't want to mess it up. You say it correctly the way you are.
Oh, well, billionaires is correct, but it's sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. Okay, that's our actual coming future. And we'll be beings in some ways not unlike the spectacular characters that we read about, these amazing flamboyant characters that we read about in comics. We'll have capabilities in some ways similar to those. I don't know that we'll be superheroes in the sense that we'll, as I said in my blog post the other day, put on masks and dress up in spandex and go out and fight crime, as satisfying as that would be. But we'll have amazing abilities the way comic book characters do. And speaking of that blog post, this came as a complete shock to me. I had no idea that there is such a movement. Stephen, are you familiar with this, I guess, really burgeoning movement, this growing movement of people assuming superhero identities and going out and attempting to fight crime as superheroes?
You know, I think a couple of years ago, Phil, on this show, I stated, you know, it's surprising with all the different subcultures that there are in the United States, that there aren't people out there holding themselves out to be superheroes, dressed in spandex, you know, being vigilantes. Why is it that we haven't seen people like that? Well, it's apparently it's
ahead of your time, as always, my friend. There it is.
Well, you know,
you nailed it. I mean,
this is
a happening thing. I would have guessed that at best or at worst, however you want to look at this, people would be inclined to join a club, right, where they dress up like superheroes and maybe act out elaborate fantasy role play adventures, something like Civil War reenactors or something like that, right? You know, you might get your Justice League together and they could take on the Secret Society of supervillains or something like that. But no, what's the fun of that? These people are actually assuming these identities for real and seriously going out. And, you know, one of the YouTube clips I linked in the blog post, I can't remember who said it, but somebody noted that a policeman had observed that they haven't actually like stopped any crimes yet, right? That, you know, these folks are out there doing what they do, but as far as actually busting up crimes or turning in criminals, not a lot of that has gone on. They do a lot of volunteer stuff. You know, they distribute food to the poor, and I mean they do good things. You know, help people across the street, and it's a wonderful thing. But one of the stories in one of the YouTube clips that I linked was one of these guys. I think it might have been Red Phoenix, who his picture is shown there in that video over at the Speculist. Take a look. I think he's got the coolest costume, by the way, of any. By the way, this is an interesting discussion point. Do superheroes wear costumes or do they wear uniforms?
I think they wear costumes because a uniform would mean they'd all be wearing the same thing. I think that you could argue that the Fantastic Four wear uniforms.
Ah.
You know, the rest
but like
of the
Batman
superheroes,
wears a costume.
That's right, because there's no, you know, there's nobody else. Even his sidekick doesn't wear a costume like his costume. You know, he's a Robin. So,
right.
You know.
But there's so many Robins now. If you've been following Detective Comics,
true.
There's like four. That's almost a uniform. Okay, I see the distinction. I'm gonna take that distinction. To me, it always seemed more like a uniform because that sounds more like official and military, and costume sounds more like Halloween dressing up, right? But
right.
But I think you're right. I think technically, in terms of what the words mean, that you've got it nailed. So anyway, Red Phoenix, he's got the best costume of any of them. He's actually got the fake muscles built in, kind of like Batman in the movies. And
yeah.
He just looks tough. In his interview, he shouldn't talk. He shouldn't give interviews because it kind of blows it. He doesn't have that good Batman vocal thing going. And also, I just think generally, a superhero like that wouldn't give an interview. You know, imagine like Spider-Man sits down in the studio and talks to the, you know, Katie Couric or something like that. You know,
let's face it, if somebody hears our voice, they have a pretty good chance of picking out who we are if they happen to know us. You know,
right. Right. Well,
you know,
Red Phoenix, he commits no clause on top of that because he starts talking about how many kids he has, what kind of work he used to do, and I'm just like, dude, okay. You know?
You're blowing it, man. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it's like,
it's not just decent citizens who watch this show. Supervillains watch this show, okay? So, you got to think about it.
That's right. You got to be careful about these things.
You got to think about who you're communicating with. Anyway, I guess he decided that this guy was too drunk to be driving, okay? And so it's like 2-3 in the morning, and he has intervened and is preventing this guy from getting into his car. And, of course, this drunk guy goes into a complete rage. Meanwhile, Red Phoenix has called the cops. The cops show up, and they sort the whole thing out. And afterward, you see the cops talking to Red Phoenix and his buddies, his superhero colleagues. And, you know, he's saying, look, I appreciate what you guys are trying to do. I know what you're doing, and I appreciate it. But you can't go getting in a drunk person's face, okay?
That's our job.
You know,
that's
as a police, this is just not behavior we can advise. So,
yeah.
you know, I think that one of the things that this whole exercise exposes is how ill-suited the superhero paradigm is to the real world.
Right.
Right. In
the
comics,
the closest thing I think that we could probably see in the real world to, like, you know, Batman or something would be more like Death Wish. You know, remember the original Death Wish? You know, his family gets attacked.
Yes. Yes.
He ends up he goes out and he gets a gun and he gets a little apartment that's away from his own home and you know, it's in a kind of a seedy district. And he just walks around and through bad areas of town, waiting to be mugged. And then when he is, he shoots the bad guy, and then he escapes. And you know, he cleans up in his little dingy apartment, and then goes home. And he did that night after night. You know, that, I think that's probably closer to the kind of vigilante that you'd actually see in the real world than you know. And I mean, he was disguising his identity, wasn't he? He kind of had his collar up, and he was, you know, had a
most importantly, he killed all the witnesses, right? I mean, that was the
exactly. Yeah.
The only witness ever was his victim.
You know,
so.
Again, I have to say this. This is not. We're not giving you advice for what you need to do.
We're not endorsing this kind of behavior. We're just analyzing the superhero phenomenon. I would say there's one analog in the real world that I can think of that is as close to a comic book superhero as the real world ever got before these folks showed up, and I'm still not sure that this might be closer. And that's this group, the Guardian Angels.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're familiar with it, for those who aren't familiar, these are like ex-gang members who, like, as a group, go in and break up gang activities. So they act kind of as a self-anointed, self-appointed law enforcement agency, and they go in and they take on the bad guys as the good guys. I mean, it's an idea. When I first heard it, I thought, you know, that would have worked as a comic book. I mean, you could actually have made that one up, and it would have worked. It's still not quite the same thing. They don't disguise themselves, and they're actually committed to not committing. They're actually nonviolent, right? They don't ever beat anybody up or anything like that. They're, they act forcefully at times, but they don't use weapons or any of that kind of stuff. So it's different from a superhero, but it's about as close as the real world ever got until these people showed up. And then when these people show up, you look at it and you go, well, this is, you know, the more you observe this, the more you understand why this whole model doesn't work, right? In the comics, the police either look at superheroes as their good friends and colleagues, like Batman and Commissioner Gordon, or they look at superheroes as renegades and criminals themselves, like the cops in New York and Spider-Man traditionally, or even all the rest of the cops in Gotham City and Batman. But in real life, you know, it's viewed as more of an annoyance, right? I mean, the immediate response from the police is, you know, we would laugh at this, but it's just more irritating than anything else that these people are doing this. Now, why is that? What's the difference? I think probably the major difference is that in the comics, these fictional characters are effective, right? they can actually do something. In real life, even a highly trained individual, you know, even somebody who's like a Navy SEAL, who dons a costume and goes out into the street and decides he's going to take on the bad guys, is probably just getting himself in trouble, right? I mean, if he's unarmed, he really doesn't stand much of a chance against armed criminals. And so this becomes like just one more factor that the cops have to deal with, one more person that they have to try to keep safe, one more person who might get hurt, and one more person who might put other people or police at risk. So I think the until somebody actually shows up with superpowers, the response to these folks is going to be one of annoyance more than anything else. I think they're going to be viewed as a nuisance.
There is one way, I suppose, that we normal people can help is, you know, anytime we witness crime, we all have cell phones now. Dial 911. This has happened to me on a number of occasions. I'll be driving along on the interstate and I see somebody all over the road. You know, it's a Friday night and I'm on the interstate at, 9, 10 o'clock at night and somebody's all over the road, pull out the cell phone, dial 911, you know, this guy's out here, he's about to kill someone. I just passed mile marker, whatever. And I'm headed west, can y'all come stop this guy? And I've done that two or three times. And once out of those three times that I did that, the cops actually showed up and stopped this guy and got him. But as far as just confronting a criminal, you're probably going to get yourself in trouble. Police when they do that, they're usually in groups. They got backup. They're on the radio with other. That's leave it to those guys. And be a good citizen and report it. And report crime when you see it. That's something we can do.
Yeah, I mean, you get into all these kinds of hypotheticals. What if you see a crime being committed? I still think you call 911. You know, what if you see somebody hurting someone else? Then suddenly another set of impulses kicks in, right? And I'm nobody's superhero.
Right.
I'm never going to dress up. But there is a point at which I would probably attempt to intervene, even if it was a stupid thing to do, just because, you know, you can't stand by and allow certain things to happen. But I think what you're talking about doing really fits well with the whole paradigm of being a sexy immortal billionaire with superpowers, because what you're in fact doing, Stephen, when you whip out the mobile phone, is you're using your superpowers, right? We're using the abilities that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I have telepathy now.
Exactly. We've got a line right into the police that goes with us all the time, right? And we got GPS.
Right.
We can give them coordinates. We can take a picture and send it to them. I mean, there's all kinds of it's like we're all carrying around a utility belt now with these smartphones. So even though I agree that we're on the civilian end of it, feeding intelligence into the law enforcement agencies, acting as auxiliary dispatchers and people who provide additional information. We're highly empowered to do that now. We've got we've got a tremendous ability to do that, we should take advantage of that. I mean, we should anyway. Obviously, even before the age of the smartphone, if you see something like that going on, there is a duty to do something about it. But the point's well taken. You know, if you're driving down the highway 20 years ago, what are you going to do, right? You don't have any way of reporting that if somebody's, driving drunk. You get home 2 hours later, you're going to call the cops then. It seems pretty pointless, at that point. But with the phone on you, you're able to do that. This is one of the things that has actually empowered children to a certain extent. They're all carrying cameras around now, and there's an understanding that they're not as easy to victimize if they can take a picture of their attacker and send it to someone before the attacker is able to make any additional moves. So it's an odd way of gaining powers. It's not the powers it's not the ones you would think about. It's not the ones you necessarily read about in the comics. We don't have super speed or we haven't become bulletproof. But by being connected, and by having access to information, having a communication infrastructure that didn't exist before, we are significantly empowered over the kinds of abilities we had even just a few years ago. And I think that we can expect to see that trend continue. And
well,
a dozen years or so from now, we'll look back and we'll go, "Wow, back then we had no idea how potent we could be in actually warding off crime."
Well, here's an excellent example, Phil. That I mean, one of the best examples I can think of is what happened on 9/11. You know, I mean, pretty much when you're hijacked, I mean, the way things were before 9/11 was, you're just going to take an interesting plane ride someplace. So you'll get set down. There'll be some demands made, and eventually they'll let everybody go. You know, so everybody just sit tight and wait for this to be over. Everybody be all right. Well, because there were these phones, these seatback phones. The people in the aircraft learned what had happened in New York City, and they attacked and kept the airplane from hitting Washington D.C. And so that was just ordinary people that learned something that was going on, and it changed the paradigm. All of a sudden, we're not going to sit here and just die here in our seats. We're gonna fight. And so, that's probably one of the best examples I can think of.
That is true. That is true. Is a real kind of, what is it? It's a role change, right? It's an understanding of a new role for ourselves. Where before we thought, okay, well, the authorities have told us not to. It's actually almost the opposite of what we were just saying, but it's really true in this instance. Whereas before the authorities always told us, sit tight, don't try to do anything, you'll only mess things up, you'll only make it worse. Now it's just understood. If you're in that, if I'm ever in that, situation, God forbid, I'm going to try to do something, right? I think
right.
Everybody came out of that observing that experience, thinking that I will coordinate with others or just take a leap myself, but I'm going to try to do something. I'm not just going to sit there and take it. And I wonder if that.
Think of the shoe bomber.
Itself, what's that?
Think of the shoe bomber. I mean, that guy pulls out a match and tries to light his shoe on fire. Well, of course, he's trying to blow up the airplane.
Yeah,
it's a C4 or something. I don't know what he was doing, but. Of course, he's tackled by about five people almost simultaneously. You know, I mean, he's it's understood now. You don't, in the context of an airplane, you know, you don't allow things like that to happen.
Yeah, anybody tries to set their shoes or underwear on fire, they're in for it, absolutely. And that makes me wonder, Stephen. This is just a theory. This is just a wild speculation here, but that's what this show is all about, after all. I wonder if 9/11 had something to do with the fact that now there's people trying to be real superheroes.
You know, there may be something to that.
Huh?
It's this idea that in the right circumstances, ordinary people are expected to act. You know, and perhaps there's. There's people that feel like that they need back in certain times. You know, I think rather than dress up as a superhero, keep bottled water and stuff like that available. And next time a hurricane hits South Louisiana, I might just drop down there and start passing out water or something, blankets.
I mean, there's a lot to be said for just the spirit of involvement, the spirit of feeling that you have something to contribute. And I think that's the really good side of these folks. I've had a little bit of fun at their expense, and if you watch the videos, you'll have more fun at their expense, I'm sure. But the notion ultimately that they want to help, right? This is the thing that Commissioner Gordon said about Batman in Batman Begins. I think he's trying to help. These people want to do something positive. They want to do something constructive in the face of what they see as a lot of trouble and a lot of danger and a lot of risk. And if nothing else, that is admirable, and that's a wonderful thing. I just want to say for Sally's benefit, I see what's happening here in the chat room. They won't let her use the name Dick Tracy. So I want to say Dick Tracy here on the show. Big Dick Tracy fans here, and I'm just going to say, the man's name was Dick. Okay, we should be allowed to call Dick. I think on the show and in the chat room, that's pretty silly that we can't call Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy, that was his name. Okay, so kind of a precursor to superheroes, really, when you think about.
Dick
Tracy, gadget fiction a la James Bond, right?
Exactly.
Although it got pretty weird later in the 60s. It got very science fiction-y, and they went to the moon and all kinds of crazy stuff. They were flying around those hovercrafts. But originally it was the wrist radios, our first generation analog mobile phones on a wristwatch, which later became the wrist TVs and all kinds of wonderful gadgets. But yeah, Dick Tracy is a good kind of precursor from the comic world of some of the technology we have today, as was Star Trek. Although as we've pointed out on numerous occasions on this show, that the Star Trek technology projected for hundreds of years from now, other than the warp drive and the transporter. Most of what we've got now, right? We've got computers as sophisticated, maybe more sophisticated in some ways. We've got communications devices that are more sophisticated. But it's hard to get those things
right. I got to ask you this, Phil, real quick, while we're on the subject of Star Trek. Star Trek, this is a trivia question. See if you've got some geek skills here. Star Trek II, at the beginning of it, Kirk is celebrating his birthday. He is given two antiques. Can you name those antiques? Well, one friend gives him one antique, another friend gives him another antique.
You can't seriously think I don't know the answers to these questions. it's a pair of antique glasses, and it's I don't know if it's a first edition, but it's a very, very old copy of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens.
I think the key was that it was a paper book.
Oh.
Yeah,
it's never
said
that it's A Tale of Two Cities. They just read the first line and the last line, and anybody who ever had to read that in high school knows the book. But you're right. It's a pair of glasses and a paper book. I'm sorry. I nerded out on that answer. I gave more detail than you needed.
No, you did great. You did great. Well, I thought I'd just bring it back around to the whole ebook thing and Star Trek. Thought I'd tie it in.
There you go. No, it's a good point. In the Star Trek universe, a paper book is it's an interesting collector's item. It's an interesting oddity to have. And we later see Kirk sitting in his quarters trying to read it with the glasses. He's got the glasses on. He's got the glasses off. He just doesn't know what to do with any of this bizarre 20th century or earlier infrastructure. Okay, well, let's see. We've got some more supporting evidence for a coming world of sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. I don't really feel superheroes add too much to it, except to say that they'd be more effective probably if they had some powers. I guess that's where I was going with the superpowers. Or that the superpowers we currently have are more effectively used. Maybe that's really our lesson, our takeaway on that. The superpowers that we currently have are more effectively used in an adjunct kind of a role rather than a direct taking on the bad guys kind of a role. But other stories that we had supporting that, did you see the story of I found this one on Facebook, and I was just delighted by this story. Carmen Del Orefice, the 80-year-old supermodel.
I did see it, and what an interesting story. This lady, and we ought to put a link up in the chat room, Phil. It's this lady has been in modeling 65 years.
She was on the cover of Vogue at age 15, and 65 years later, she's still on the catwalk, still modeling, and I'm going to say still looks pretty darn good. Amazingly good, in fact.
Well, my takeaway from this, Phil, is that, this lady, obviously she doesn't age like most of the rest of us. You know, I mean, she certainly doesn't look like she looked when she was 15. But, you know, I showed a picture to, you know, my wife and said, you want to hazard a guess as to how old this lady was? I didn't say that she was, a supermodel, and that what's remarkable about her was how old she was. I just, how old do you think this lady is? She's probably in her 50s. What about it? Well, she's 80, and she looks she looks like an attractive lady in her mid to early 50s. And she's just, the years have just been very, very kind. And my thought is this, we just don't all age the same. There are people that look pretty darn old by the time they're my age. And then there's this lady who is looking great at double my age. And so, if we can just figure out what's going on for her biologically versus most of the rest of us, maybe there's some things that we can learn, about staying healthy and staying young looking longer.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's so encouraging about this story is you see her doing this in a world where we really don't yet have life extension. So we know that there are these outliers, as you say, who have the ability to, who are gifted with the ability to stay vital and stay younger a lot longer than others. Yeah, we want to emulate that across the board, and ultimately we want to find a way to provide that to everybody. But when you look at that and you say 80-year-old supermodel, you start to think, wow, how long before, 50-year-old starting quarterback, right? Or whatever it might be, a 100-year-old college freshman, or, whatever the juxtaposition of numbers and ideas would be, because that age doesn't go with that job, and yet here's someone doing it. It's not immortality, and even in the sexy immortal billionaires and superpowers paradigm, the immortality we talk about there isn't truly living forever, but it's more a matter of indefinite youth, more a matter of indefinite vitality. I look at her and I say, this is an inspiration for us. This is the suggestion that this can happen, that a human being can stay young and vital till much later than traditionally people would have thought, and we need to improve on that. We need to improve on that, and we need to find a way to make that available to more people.
I see Sally hit the punchline on a joke just a little ahead of me in the chat room. Ken states, you know, avoiding cursing helps keep you looking young. And Sally and I hit almost simultaneously, damn. Anyway, it's too late for me, my son.
Yeah, it's not going to help me at this point. We can go back to the Dick Tracy discussion if you want to, but I think it's hopeless for me. Okay, so let's keep moving on because we got more evidence of sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers as a coming thing. This next one is just a quick story from the New York Times: Disruptions, the 3D printing free for all. Talking about, I don't know if you had a chance to look at this piece, Stephen, but talking in fairly analytical mode about, wow, what does this mean? I mean, no longer is this speculation about maybe someday we'll have machines that will enable us to, which is what 3D printers do, enable us to produce goods ourselves, produce for ourselves goods that normally prior to that we would have had to have gone to a store and buy. They're getting deep into the issues here. You know, where does copyright kick in? And something I learned that I hadn't ever thought about before is that for functional items, as opposed to purely decorative items, functional items are not subject to intellectual property protection. So
that's right.
So if you take photographs of the example they give is a coffee mug. They also give an example of a chair. But anything that actually serves a purpose, and you recreate that on your 3D printer, you've not violated any intellectual property laws. And in fact, that's a perfect
valid. Well, I have to take a little bit of an issue with that.
Okay.
You know, copyright obviously protects intellectual property. Okay, and then patents protect, you know, like functional inventions. Okay, so
of course, and that would be the next step. That you're absolutely right. I mean, that no one is suggesting that if you if you reverse engineer or if you build an exact replica of a Maserati that you have that you haven't violated any intellectual.
Yeah,
and at that point you have.
Yeah, if I build a better mousetrap and get it patented, and somebody comes along and prints it out with their 3D printer, then they haven't violated copyright. They've violated patent law. And so,
I was amazed to think there's so many things that are not patented. That
exactly.
Most things
that you would think about, coffee cups. I mean, just lots of things that you would want to print with a 3D printer.
Lamb,
no problem at all.
You know, I mean, those things aren't patented, and even amongst products that would be subject to intellectual property, this is the really interesting thing. This site Thingiverse, which is a free site that offers schematics for objects. So this is a place where people give away designs for things, and one of the things that you can, and not everything on Thingiverse is something that you can output with a 3D printer. There are a lot of them are just things you could handcraft yourself. Just it tells you want to make one of these desks. Here's what you need to get, and go do it. But one of the things that that they have schematics for on Thingiverse, and I was just looking at this before the show, is a 3D printer, the Mendelmax, one of several, and I should say. It's not only a 3D printer, but it meets the qualifications of a rep wrap, and we've talked about that concept on the show in the past. So, for a very small cash investment, and I'm going to think a significant amount of time, it would be for me anyway, thinking how long it took me to put up these bookcases. You can assemble a machine that you can then use to fabricate just about. Any shape of stuff that you want to make. It's hardly a universal assembler. It's hardly a Star Trek replicator. But it is a machine that will allow you to make just tons and tons of stuff. And if you go through Thingiverse, you start getting ideas for I wouldn't mind having one of those. It'd be kind of cool to make one of those. A lot of it is just stuff that you would pick up at Walmart or you know, Target or someplace like that and not think anything about it. You know, it's just inexpensive items that are nearly commoditized anyway. But the idea that those are no longer items that you would even need to make that trip for, that you could just say, oh, here, I'll just make one, and that you could do it to your own specs, that starts to get pretty interesting. And, of course, the real headline here, the real news with these is where they lead eventually, and where that is to increasingly complex material, increasingly large, and ultimately, this technology does become a, if not a threat to, just a replacement for the existing kind of manufacturing and retail infrastructure that we have. We're not anywhere near that yet, but you can see the hint of it to come. And what does this have to do with us being sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers? Well, this is the billionaire part. I mean, once you have a machine that will make anything you want, you're a billionaire. You know, I mean, you've got the same control over the universe that a billionaire does, to the extent that a billionaire can buy whatever he or she wants. A person with a sophisticated enough replication device can just fabricate whatever he or she wants. You've accomplished eventually, spending equity. You've accomplished market power equity with the very rich by virtue of the fact that that you can produce anything that you want to produce. Now, we're a long way away from that. That's not going to happen this week, and it's not going to happen next year. But I think you can see you can see the handwriting on the wall. The New York Times sees it because now they're doing a story about what are the intellectual property issues around this, not a story about whether this will ever be possible.
Here's the thing. I think for right now, I think that we're going to see desktop 3D printers remaining a little bit sort of a hobby kind of thing for a while. I don't see it being the sort of thing that, you know, if I want a toothbrush, I'm not going to normally, even if I had one on my desk, I don't think I'm going to print it. The cost and the time involved in printing it, you know, I can just swing by and pick one up for a few cents at the local, you know, drugstore. I think where these things are going to change our life first will not be in the home, but will be at the local Walmart or something. That, you know, Walmart will probably at some point, or, you know, stores like that, will own, you know, very expensive replicating machines. You know, maybe something that, you know, we in the home wouldn't have, you know, a $100,000 machine that would allow them to manufacture in the store lots of things that, you know, instead of, and that, you know, we cut out the shipping, we cut out the middleman, we pocket the difference, and a smart retailer would then, you know, sink the money into a very expensive machine that would make the sort of things that people would buy in their store, and quickly just turn them out that way. That's where they'll change your life first. There'll be a lot of that happening. Then I think that these very expensive machines will be shrunk and they'll end up back in our home that way. You know, much better, much faster, and much more useful when that second or third or fourth generation hits our homes. Then after, you know, going through a phase where they're just primarily in big stores. So
I think that's a great point. That probably the first really useful iteration of these will not be in the home. Will probably be in some other setting. Either a Walmart gets smart, or some new competitor to Walmart comes along, right? Because you don't need a big Walmart warehouse type setting for this. You could operate a store that will sell just about anything in a very small space. With one of these machines. So it might actually be a whole new retail chain or a very clever existing retail chain who decides, hey, I think we'll just start selling everything else. In addition to whatever it is we sell, because we can put one of these machines in here, and we can cut way into Walmart's business or Target's business, even though we're not in that market. I think you make a good point. It'll start out as a very expensive kind of industrial piece of machinery that then works its way down to a truly useful home appliance, kind of like the way computers did, right? Ultimately the way printers did. The way everything does over time. Great point. Okay, well, we've got one last story. That actually does it for the Sexy Immortal Billionaires with Superpowers, but I wanted to give a quick update on a subject we talked about last week. We had Ramez Nam on last week. We were talking about the solar singularity, and we got onto the subject of power plants in space. And, Stephen, I think you have an update on that.
Absolutely. The IAA says that they're very feasible with existing technology. Now, they're talking about a lot of this technology is still in labs, but it's already proven science that what we can do is we can collect this in space, solar power, beam it to Earth either with lasers or with microwaves, and just throw it into the grid then. And there's lots of things that you solve by doing it that way. You get solar power 24 hours a day if you're collecting it in space. You know, it's no there's no nighttime. You know, you just always have your collector pointed at the sun, and you're beaming it home. You're in geosynchronous orbit above a certain point, and you're beaming it home whether it's night or day. And so you don't have to worry about storing the power. It's being fed into the grid 24/7, like a coal-fired power plant. And so they're saying,
absolutely.
Yeah, we can do this. This is feasible. It's just a matter of getting the hardware into space. So we need some heavy lift ability, don't we?
Yeah, they're talking about 10 to 20 years. They're saying it could be cost-effective in 30 years. One of the objections to this raised in the comments on this story I thought was interesting was, well, what about the carbon footprint of all these launch vehicles it's going to take to create and support that infrastructure? And I thought, well, if these people only listened to Fast Forward Radio, then they would know that the alternative to that is the airships to space. I mean, that's what got us onto that subject to begin with. I want to see us put a new launch infrastructure in place that doesn't require all that fuel and that doesn't take that whole heavy energy-consuming approach that our current infrastructure makes. It seems to me that these two ideas are made for each other, that if anyone is really serious about putting power plants in space, they should get serious about lighter-than-air craft moving us closer to space because there's a real, it seems to me, kind of resonance and synergy between those ideas. I hope to see both of those taking place in the near future. Okay, well, that's going to do it for our topics this evening. Stephen, what's our music?
Okay, our music tonight is Dreamer's Overture by J.T. Bruce. This song is the beginning of an entire album, and if you like this first song as much as I did, you're going to want to go hear the whole album just like I did. It's pretty awesome stuff. So, the Dreamer's Overture.
Right. J.T. Bruce with Dreamer's Overture. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Always great talking with you about this stuff. Thank you all for listening to Fast Forward Radio. Special shout out to everyone who participated. Great chat that we had going on this evening. We'll be back again next week with another brand new show. Hope you'll be able to join us. And until next time, live to see it.